Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, a former state Supreme Court justice tapped to lead an election investigation surrenders his law license and part of a new settlement. Plus, lawmakers debate bills targeting our election and unemployment laws, and how members of Wisconsin's delegation are reacting to the Trump administration's tariffs. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 11th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We begin this week with a name that we haven't talked about in quite some time, former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. Well, he's back in the news this week after he reached a settlement with the Office of Lawyer Regulation related to a 75-page complaint all tied into his 2020 investigation into the election. Now, he did reach a tentative deal with the Office of Lawyer Regulation, which could suspend his law license for 3 years. And like I mentioned, this is all tied to that complaint that alleged that he violated multiple rules of professional conduct during his probe into the 2020 election. Of course, that came up with no evidence of widespread voter fraud. He was kind of denounced by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who even said, you know, I wish his law license was suspended after he didn't find any evidence. And now that this deal, tentative deal, I should say, that he reached with the office now goes before somewhat of a referee before the state Supreme Court ultimately decides his fate.
Yeah, and actually three of his former colleagues could be the ones who helped decide what happens to him. So in this process, it's like pleading no contest in a criminal case. Obviously, he's not criminal, but what he's saying is, you guys can prove what you've alleged against me, and I can't really defend myself. So let's try and reach a settlement and move forward. What's interesting here is kind of the tale of Michael Gableman. So you pull back, look historically. In 2018, he decided not to run for another 10-year term in the Supreme Court. At the time, there was talk about, well, is he going to get a job in the Trump administration? And nothing came of that. And then he kind of faded from view for a while. Robin Voss said he found him working at Home Depot when they picked him up to go work over the 2020 election, do this kind of review of what happened. He had this platform, this lifeline from Robin Voss to get back into like the political limelight and have a platform to do things. And then things went off the rails. And that's what Robin Voss says about the guy who hired him, that he went off the rails, went down these rabbit holes, kind of irritated Voss, got mocked incessantly, gets fired. He runs up a big legal tab for the state with these lawsuits, and then he has these complaints filed against him. Law Forward filed one, a judge overseeing part of an open records case filed one, and now we reach this. And now he's at a point where he's raised concerns in the filings that he can't, about the cost of this. So they want to sit for a deposition, all right, to kind of give his side of the story in this whole thing. He, one, said, I've got concerns about maybe there being criminal charges coming out of this, and two, the legal costs. It paints a picture of somebody who's not in a great place financially and has got this legal tab going up saying, I've got to get out of this thing and get out of it quickly. So you have this kind of quick comeback. There's a people talking about running for Supreme Court again during this whole process. And this fall, once again from grace, where does he go from here? It's his late 50s, I believe. There's not a great kind of like future looking for Michael Gableman after, legally speaking, you know, like what he does a law career.
And especially when you rack up, you know, $2.3 million in fees that taxpayers are going to have to pay for something that you didn't really end well with. It doesn't sit well. So not really much to run on a platform or even to appease the second Trump administration. All right, let's move on to a new Democratic bill this week, which would make it harder for billionaires like Elon Musk to hand out $1 million checks to voters. What we're talking about is what Democrats are coining their election bribery bill, which would enhance the state's election bribery laws, which would prohibit voters from signing election-related petitions. Now, remember, Elon Musk had this whole petition and awarded three Wisconsin voters with $1 million checks in Green Bay. And Democrats, of course, introduced this bill just blocks away where Elon Musk handed out this money. Let's just first hear from one of the authors of the bill, Representative Lee Snodgrass, making her appeal to lawmakers on why they should back this.
When you talk to people in Wisconsin, Republicans and Democrats and people in between are basically saying this felt wrong. This didn't feel right to us. Interfering in this way is essentially bribery disguised as civic engagement. So we want to make sure that we had a statute on the books. Hopefully we'll get a hearing where we can say, you know what, if you're going to do this in Wisconsin, it's very clear that you're running afoul of the law.
Now, of course, this comes after Susan Crawford's big victory. Elon Musk was a huge factor in that election. Also, he invested more than $20 million into the contest. But there's always a but, right? This bill could likely face an uphill battle in the GOP-controlled legislature, reached out to some Republicans on the election committee. Haven't heard back from them yet on where they are at with this bill. So it could face somewhat of a challenge to get onto the floor.
So state law right now bars offering the value to somebody to vote or not to vote. This would expand it to include signing petition, various petitions during a quote-unquote election period. So there's one possible red flag. They're trying to say, here's the window where you can't do this kind of stuff and get any value from someone for signing it. There's been lawsuits that issue advocacy-type bills that kind of raise some red flags about that, so there's that piece. The bigger problem is this is a Democratic bill in a Republican-controlled legislature, basically trying to pour salt in the wound for Republicans over Elon Musk. Not a great winning combination with the legislature right now, so people have their doubts it's going to go very far, but it's part of a messaging thing. You have Elon Musk played the central role in the Supreme Court race, along with Donald Trump, and, you know, of course, Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel as well, but it's a chance to keep, like, bringing this up and exciting the base for Democrats of, hey, you don't like this guy, Elon Musk, he tried to do this with all this money, you should still be mad about this going forward in the near future. About him.
Right, and there was another bill that kind of paired with this on the same day when it was introduced that targets big money, dark money in politics, also that they wanted to propose through a constitutional amendment, an advisory referendum, also another factor that's unlikely going to gain support in the legislature. All right, now we're going to wrap. A lot of bills were actually heard in public hearings this week and exact out of committee, and we just want to highlight a few of them because, of course, when they go through the committee, we're going to be talking about them likely in a few weeks when they head to the floor. Let's start with some unemployment bills. AB 169 would require employees to report to the Department of Workforce Development if someone fails to show up for a job interview. The next bill would expand what constitutes as misconduct for those ineligible for unemployment. Also saw some election-related bills in wake that kind of correlates to Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s lawsuit as he tried multiple times through multiple courts to try to remove his name off the ballot during the 2024 presidential election cycle. This is what that bill would do. It would allow candidates to essentially more easily withdraw their name from Wisconsin ballots. There was also another proposal that would restrict third-party candidates to nominate electors. Of course, all of these bills here, JR, proposed by Republicans.
And a lot of them proposed before, not the stuff related to RFK Jr. in the 24 election, but these things about unemployment, they've been up before. We get like theme days from the assembly,
yes,
a lot of times on the floor. So what this tells me is there's gonna be a theme day coming up about the social safety net. So unemployment, there's also a bill out there about guaranteed income programs introduced before, didn't go very far. We're gonna get a theme day talking about how we need to not have this stuff, make it a little bit harder for people to be on social welfare programs and make, as Scott Walker says, not a hammock, but a trampoline, whatever the phrase is, right? So they're going to have that theme. We're going to have an election theme someday. This is all going to get to, like, we'll get to the floor and have these bills come up together, and we'll have a main central argument for Robin Voss and some of the Republicans.
And speaking of election-related bills, too, when they had their public hearing earlier this week, I pulled aside the chairman, Representative Maxey of the Assembly Elections Committee, and asked him, hey, what about Monday processing, right? We just had an election. It's a bill that is always talked about here leading up to an election, after election. Of course, this is the bill that would allow clerks to begin processing ballots the day before, the Monday before an election. I asked him about it. He was a little weary about it, which is kind of, a stance that he's taking as chairman when it was last year, who's now the co-chair, Representative Scott Krug, who was really spearheading this and trying to get this through the legislature. My conversation with Maxey then turned to Central Count, and he told me he would like to essentially eliminate it, abolish it, only in Milwaukee. Let's just take a listen to what he had to say earlier this week.
They started pretty early this time, but it did not need to be done at Central Count. When I went to different polling locations, I was at 7 or 8 that day, I saw people standing, waiting for something to do, where they could have been processing absentee ballots. I would like to get rid of Central Count Milwaukee.
We've had Central Counts all over the state since, and it's worked well. It leads to timely counting of votes and timely reporting. This is just another attempt to pick on Milwaukee and its sour grapes, period.
As you just heard, that was the Democratic commissioner from WEC, Mark Thompson, who was really critical of the idea of eliminating Central Count in Milwaukee. That's been there for many, many years. They view it as a very public forum where they can count ballots, process them in a timely manner. However, Maxey believes they should just get rid of it altogether, which would essentially be a very bold move, but he has not drafted any legislation. He says as chairman, he doesn't want to draft bills that could come before his committee, but definitely a talker this week.
So Central Count Milwaukee has been like the boogeyman for Republicans about elections because, like we saw in November, there was a surge in votes for Democrats, especially Tammy Baldwin, that put her ahead of Eric Hovde, became part of Hovde's like conspiracy theory-laden argument about why he lost that race. I get that. But there's Central Count in Green Bay and Wauwatosa and Kenosha and all these other communities. And if you're not going to talk about those, if you're going to pick on Milwaukee, you're not going to get past Governor Evers. Number one, Governor Evers is not going to like tell Milwaukee how to do things. That's not his style. Number two, if you're singling out Milwaukee for stuff, not a great chance that bill becoming law, even if your fellow Republicans were to go along with it.
Right. There's actually more than 40 municipalities that use a central count system. All right. Let's move on to some other bills that were talked about in committee this week. We're talking about flag bans. Mm-hmm. I believe we talked about this on the show before. AB 58 would ban gay pride flags, Black Lives Matters, thin blue lines, all of those type of things from being flown at state and local government buildings. Meanwhile, another proposal, also target flags, would only allow certain flags, really just about U.S., Wisconsin flags. There would be a series of exceptions like POW, MIA, missing in action flags to be flown outside state and government buildings. Meanwhile, we also had a criminal justice hearing on a bill that would impose stiffer penalties on unlicensed drivers and car owners if they lent their car to someone involved in an accident. Now, there was some compelling testimony this week about that bill because there was victims who were impacted by unlicensed drivers who really made pleas to lawmakers to propose or to pass this legislation. Let's just first just hear from some individuals testifying on this matter.
While getting on the school bus, my youngest son was struck by a driver that was following too close to the bus, not paying attention. While he is physically unharmed, the mark left on our family is not unnoticed. This driver, William Melcher, has a long history of driving infractions stemming from drinking. There are three different vehicles that he was operating illegally without an IID, and I can say that one for certain was not registered to him. What about the other two? Who do they belong to? The bill that is being proposed would create a stiff penalty for owners who provide their vehicle to drivers who are not legally able to operate them. After a stiff $1,000 fine, would you lend your car to a friend or a family member who is supposed to have an IID? This bill will disincentivize owners from illegally lending vehicles and remove opportunities for these illegal drivers to hurt our loved ones. We need to stop the enablers. The people who are dangerous and refuse to abide by the law can have their access to vehicles restrained by firmly penalizing those who knowingly provide it.
So there, obviously, you heard from someone impacted by an unlicensed driver who actually hit his son while waiting for a school bus in New Berlin. What the bill would do right now, if you are caught with an unlicensed, or if you're driving without a license, or someone lends you a car, you receive a penalty, often a misdemeanor sometimes, no jail time. This bill would increase it from $100 penalty to $1,000. And what the bill sponsor really argued here is that no one's really enforcing this. You have a lot of people who say, yeah, sure, borrow my car, and it's involved in an accident, and then it's a he said, she said type of movement of, well, who's responsible, who's liable for these incidents. There was some pushback from Republicans and Democrats who thought this was a little bit of a step too far just because of how much it could cost. One example that Representative Tip McGuire talked about during the committee hearing is, well, what if your grandson, you know, lies to you and says, yeah, I got an active driver's license, and, you know, grandma's on a fixed income, and she now is caught with a $1,000 penalty. Meanwhile, shifting back over to the flag bans, JR, these are all, of course, really in response to Governor Evers. Of course, when he was first sworn into office, was the first time the gay pride flag was flown over the state capitol back in 2019.
So we're talking about all assembly bills, which isn't a coincidence because they're actually pushing a lot of stuff through the committee process. Now, no offense to the Senate, they're not really as active right now with committee stuff, and there are a number of reasons for that. But I was joking with a couple senators this week. I'm like, you guys are making it easy to cover the Senate this session so far. It's not been super busy. Here we are. We're going to mid-April. Not looking like any floor action next week. It's really been kind of quiet legislatively. Now, the question
there was an election, though.
There was an election. Yes. And there's another question about whether some coming Supreme Court decisions will unleash a flood of bills, maybe, because you keep Republicans say we're waiting to find out what the court's going to do on X, Y, and Z. So maybe that helps. But it also gets to the fact Republicans in the Senate had this narrow majority, 18-15. They're not finding a lot of ways to get stuff done right now. So I'm wondering, is it being held up by legislation, such as we call it, you know, ROFR, right of first refusal? Or are they distracted? Like, what is going on that's keep holding things back? It's a lot of stuff. But again, not real busy so far in the legislature.
Jerry, you just tipped off the next topic. ROFR, your favorite topic beyond redistricting, I would think. Of course, I'm kidding here. We want to bring up this bill. Why? Because there was a series of changes to try and appease a lot of Republicans in the Assembly. We had some lawmakers who are very opposed to ROFR, which is now coined the Wisconsin Energy Reform Act. And this is what all politics is about. You know, it's about the sausage making. What do you want in this bill that I can gain your support? Let's just talk a little bit about the new elements. This bill would expand competitive bidding for some projects. It also would address farmland preservation. There's also new lighting requirements for wind systems and high voltage transmission lines. It would require the Legislative Audit Bureau to review 15% of transmission facility construction contracts, all these type of things that, yes, very wordy, very wonky, but it would matter to some people if this was actually gets through the legislature.
So, okay, right of first refusal, what does that actually mean? Well, we have in Wisconsin probably like $3 billion in projects coming to build new transmission lines. There is this 14-state region that oversees the grid, and they've approved all these new projects to go through. They're letting out the projects. We're in line for that $3 billion. The question is, if you have something called ROFR in place, right of first refusal, do you save money? Why I bring that up is when you build a transmission line, you go bid it, right? If you have competition, opponents argue, you drive them across the front end. The proponents of ROFR say actually the way this system works, if you have a ROFR, if you give incumbent utilities that have transmission facilities right now, they get first shot to build the lines, you can actually spread more of the cost across the region rather than Wisconsin ratepayers paying for it. It saves money in the long term. I know, it's super sexy. Really gets the attention of people at home.
Yeah.
I've never seen a bill that gets this much attention by lawmakers that splits majority caucuses as badly as this one does. Normally, something that splits the caucuses would be dead. I mean, there's this kind of unwritten rule of you must have 17 votes majority part in the Senate and 50 in the Assembly to pass a bill. They're nowhere close to that right now in either chamber. So now we have this. And why do we have this? Because utilities who want this bill write big checks at campaign time. They are a major player in politics. They want this done. You can't ignore them if you are Robin Voss and Devin Lemahue because, A, the policy, they believe in the policy. B, you have an election next year. Your majorities are on the line. You don't want to aggravate. Now, not to say they do it only because of donations, but these are friends. If you alienate your friends, that may have an impact next fall. So what's this thing come up? Well, it's basically Christmas tree time. What happens in the sausage-making process is, okay, we've got a bill, and people aren't happy about it, so what can I add to this bill to make you happy to get to a yes? Mm-hmm. Let's take Travis Trammell, for example, from Western Wisconsin, Cuba City. He's got concerns about farmland preservation. They've added a provision in this bill that it takes almost all of ROFR and puts it right back in this new bill. But it adds these provisions such as if you use what's called prime farmland for a renewable energy project, like, you know, wind or solar, you have to then buy a conservation easement. So 1 acre for a project, you buy an easement on 4 acres of prime farmland that guarantees it won't be developed for anything that's unsuitable for farming in the future. You're basically paying to make sure, okay, I'm using this acre, these will never become light development. Okay, I get that concept. Light mitigation system. So right now in tall transmission lines and tall windmills, there are constant blinking lights, right, all night long. This system would only activate if an airplane or aircraft came close. Why is that important? Well, those blinking lights are meant to make sure the planes know they're there They don't hit them, right? Nuclear energy. There's a policy, a provision that says we're going to declare nuclear energy a priority for the state on par with renewable to meet our power load. That gets other people to yes. Now, the question is, you're taking people in the assembly to get them to yes. What about in the Senate, right? This is an assembly bill. Here's a little secret about politics in Wisconsin. If there's no co-author on a bill from their chamber, it ain't got a great shot in their chambers yet. Now, things can change. Maybe they'll get a co-author. But that's why my question is this, I know this is super inside baseball, mm-hmm. is this a negotiating tactic by Robin Voss and the Senate Republicans to get momentum going, or are they eventually get the Senate to buy into this and get it passed? I don't know that answer. I don't think anybody does right now. But it's a fascinating sausage-making process in the Capitol with the most lobbied legislation last session coming back and taking a second form here in mid-April, and they want to get this thing done as soon as possible.
It's also abnormal, too, that Voss is kind of making this own bill, making these changes without input in the Senate, right? We've seen this with the Brewer's bill, right? They make a series of changes, they pass it along. Well, the Senate's like, no, our members are not going to get there. We're going to make changes. It could be a ping-pong effect. But I think the ultimate, you know, question is it even going to become or come on a floor vote? Mm-hmm. Yes, you can maybe get that threshold, but last session it was never even brought to the floor. So that's...
And for you at home, the question is going to cost you more?
Cost you more.
One
right.
way or another. I can't give you a great answer right now. So when you look at your utility bill, all right, generation is the vast majority of it. I've been told that transmission is like 10%. We're talking 1% of the 10%, I think. I can't give you a great answer. I haven't gotten one yet. I'm working on that, but I haven't got a great answer like how much this might actually cost people at home. Oh, by the way, MG&E.
They also just increased their rates.
Increase in rates. That's going to be way more than whatever this happened with this bill. But that's besides the point.
And also, I don't remember the last time that our rates actually went down.
No.
But who knows? Maybe we could be in a surprise one day, a rebate. Also, just really want to touch on tariffs, obviously, as a lot of people are starting to feel it. And a lot of people were very concerned, of course, as the president was about to enact very impactful tariffs all across the board. But then on Thursday, he paused tariffs on all countries besides China. Mm-hmm. So now China is up to, I believe, 130-some% tariff, which is a big one. So that means electronics or anything made by China, some certain clothing is still going to be expensive. But what we want to focus on is how are lawmakers, specifically Republicans, responding to this and handling this on Capitol Hill. This week, I spoke to Senator Tammy Baldwin about this issue. Of course, she criticized it, that even though that he paused this, it's still going to impact farmers. It's still going to hurt families. As you see here, her quote, Donald Trump started an unnecessary trade war across the board. They're still in place. It's still going to hurt individuals. Meanwhile, what's kind of interesting tone that Ron Johnson has been taking on this is that he's called tariffs kind of all along a double-edged sword. He also said prior to Trump's pause that this is going to be awful and cause a lot of collateral damage. He also said that it would be a real possibility that businesses could go bankrupt. But what we really want to kind of dive into is, once again, especially for House Republicans, this is kind of a fine line that they have to walk. Do they want to bash tariffs? Well, if they do, well, then you're not going to be on Trump's good side. Are you going to, you know, be primaried? Are you going to lose in 2 years? I mean, there's a lot of political ramifications of how you talk about this. And I will say, it's pretty difficult right now for us being here in Wisconsin and not in D.C. and getting Republicans, House Republicans, to talk about this issue because it's a tough one politically.
Oh, and talking about that, so November of 2016 is a long ways away. If Trump pulls this off, if somehow there are all these jobs moved back to the states, all this production back to the states the next 18 months, the markets go back up, it could be a huge winner. If it doesn't, if it causes a recession, if it gets worse than that, it goes to the D word, depression. If prices go up, inflation was down this week, right, or came in lower than expectations. There are all kinds of unknowns. That chaos does not help the incumbent party in the White House in midterm elections. So keep an eye on that. I would never predict anything a year and a half away, but if the chaos we're seeing right now persists, look what happened last week with the Supreme Court race. Again, wasn't directly because of Trump, but that environment, that energy for Democrats really helped fire up their base. That could still be there next fall.
Pocketbook issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of really drives people to the polls often. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. Rising is Ben Wickler after he announced he is going to step down from leading the state Democratic Party this June.
Yes, so not a real surprise. Wickler ran for National Party Chair earlier this year and lost. You don't pursue a big job publicly if you want to keep your current one, so that might be a factor. But you can't understate how influential he's been as state party chair in Wisconsin, maybe the most influential state party chair in Wisconsin history, if not national history. The party told me he's raised $206 million in 5.5 years, well, 5 years and 9 months,
as state party chair. Pretty small there, JR.
It's a mind-blowing number. Yeah. His record, they've won, I think, 10 of 13 races, something like that, statewide. Now, if you go back, it's not all him, go back the whole Trump years, like 12 of 15 or something like that. They've had a good streak going in off-year elections. Now they did lose a presidency last fall. That was used against him in the national party race. But Ben Wickler, as a leader, you got to give him props for what he's built with the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. The question becomes who can replace him and keep the momentum going. So there are a number of people who've, like, throwing their names out there. Devin Remiker, former executive director of the party, is already in. Joseph Pecky is an operative. He's taking the weekend to think about it, or week. William Garcia from the 3rd Congressional District. He told me he's taking the weekend to get his ducks in a row. He's 90% in by next week. Other names will float. How do you keep that going? Because nobody has Wickler's financial connections. He was from MoveOn.org, had worked in national circles, brought that in. He also can do it alone. People will tell you if you have the governor's office, if you're a party chair and have the governor's office in your party's control, it makes you easier to raise money. It just is. Evers has been a great partner with Wickler to raise money. So we can keep that going. And will the donors keep giving? Because we're not going to matter less in future elections. We're still Wisconsin. We are still like the purplest purple state. So it'll be interesting to watch if the party falls off after Wickler leaves in June or if he can keep momentum going.
All right, let's get to Mix this week. And State Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Badley is mixed because what her possibility looks like in 2026. She told you last Friday that she's going to be seeking re-election.
Yeah, so after we taped, it often happens on a Friday, you know, some news breaks. So she says she's running in 2026. She's going to find a way, spend the next couple of months figuring out how to get the resources there to run, because she mentioned that Susan Crawford had more money than Brad Schimmel, and that it gave her an advantage on the airwaves. Now, my overall look at spending it last in this spring race, $109 million roughly. Republicans had more money, conservatives more money spent overall. But again, liberals spend their money more wisely. They pump the money through the candidate. That gives them an advantage in terms of ads because they can buy versus a group, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so for Rebecca Bradley, big questions ahead. Number one, she says she's going to run. Ann Walsh Bradley told me after 2023 that she was going to run. Then she retired. Could anything persuade Rebecca Bradley not to run, like the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals? So, on Chicago, Diane Sykes is taking senior status this fall, be a vacancy to fill. Might she get tapped by the Trump administration for the appointment? You know, her name's been mentioned, like rumors go around.
Yeah, her name's been thrown around there.
Timing's kind of tough. You got to time that just right to get her confirmed before the filing deadline, January 2nd-ish, you know, for the spring races. So there's that thing. But put that aside. Let's say she's definitely running. Okay. Well, the state GOP had the money to help you out because it helped Brad Schimmel a great deal. But will national donors care as much when the race is not for control? Will Elon Musk be involved? He dropped, between him and his PACs, like $25 million. Who's going to fill that void for conservatives? But then, on the other side, so Chris Taylor's an appeals court judge. She told me she's looking at running. Pedro Colon, also appeals court judge in the first district, looking at running. Both former Democratic lawmakers. Neither of them are former prosecutor.
Which has been the winning strategy.
Yes. Yeah. The Jill Karofsky, Rebecca Dallet, Susan Crawford, Jana Prosewicz, all women, all sitting judges in Iran, all former prosecutors of some shape or form. Can you break that mold? Well, one, there's some thought that if you don't have somebody as a prosecutor, they're going to paint you as like soft on crime. Then it's Susan Crawford, so I'm not sure that matters a whole lot. But also, will liberals have as much money to spend on this race next year because it's not for the majority? They don't need this one. They also have a chance in 2027 to win that one and give themselves a buffer against 2028 when Dallet is up. So there are huge questions. So $109 million in counting this year. People bet not that much next year, but it could, might still be a tough environment for Dallet, or sorry, for Bradley, with what we're seeing in spring elections in Wisconsin, period.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, falling this week is Congressman Mark Green.
So the Doge hammer falls on somebody who's a well-known Wisconsin figure. He was the head of the Wilson Center. Doge comes in. The Trump administration is cutting stuff down. And according to the New York Times, given a choice, either be fired or step aside. And from what the Times reported, he stepped aside. Green's a former congressman, left the House to run for governor in 2006, lost that race, went on to be an ambassador to Tanzania, served in the first Trump administration, the USAID, which, by the way, took a bunch of whacks from Doge as well. here's an example of somebody who was praised by folks on both sides of the aisle for being nonpartisan in this role that he's had and being a good ambassador, just gets the wacky as a doge.
All right, that will do it for another busy week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next time.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.